Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
This is Michael Medved, and on my radio show, I'm generally concerned with what is timely, but every once in a while, we get to focus on the timeless. And when you're talking about the timeless, I immediately think of our trips to Israel. We've taken more than a dozen trips to Israel with listeners, with interested parties. Many people are going to Israel for the first time. And for the first time in 4 years, we're doing it again with Discovery Institute. Check out this remarkable opportunity, the Israel Tour at discovery.org/Israel2019. It's going to be happening in the fall of 2019, late summer, early fall. And we're going to be going with George Gilder about technology, with Stephen Meyer about science, and myself on the history and country and culture of Israel. This is going to be a remarkable experience. Please join us.
Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design. I'm your host today, Mike Keyes. We have back with us J.P. Moreland to talk more about his book, Scientism and Secularism. J.P. Moreland is Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at Biola University. Welcome back, J.P.
Wonderful to see you again, Michael. At least hear your voice.
Right, over that hum we've been fighting. So,
yes.
Okay, so, by the way, thanks also for your part in editing and writing that massive book on theistic evolution, which deals with some similar issues as your book on scientism. So thanks for that.
You're welcome, my friend.
And you've kind of circled back in your career to doing more things about science, the philosophy of science, and how it relates to the big questions. And it's been exciting to see you return to those topics that so animated your earlier career. Now, back in 2016, you were selected by the Best Schools website as one of the 50 most influential living philosophers. Now, I happen to know the guy that runs that website. He's a historian and philosopher of science like me, James Barham. And he's a versatile philosopher. He knows what he's talking about when he lists philosophers of influence like you. And I want to tell a brief story of how you influenced me. How about that?
Well, that would be an honor. Thank you.
All right. So as a young grad student working on a PhD in history of science, I and a few other friends, grad students, formed a little informal reading group called The Outer Ring, as opposed to The Inner Ring, which C.S. Lewis critiqued. And we read your first book on science and Christianity called Christianity and the Nature of Science, a Philosophical Investigation. That was back in 1989. So that's why I'm celebrating you coming back to these topics and particularly redressing scientism with more detail and contemporary analysis than you had originally. So I remember writing you, JP, in 1990, just after that book, describing our group. And there was one sentence in your book, that early book, that stood out to us. It reads, "But we greatly need more work on science and theology that is sensitive to both the history and philosophy of science." And indeed, your latest book, Scientism, deals in part with this sort of research program that you invited me and others to join. And I have loved working in this arena. And my first book, Unbelievable, reflects that. Now, let's get back to your book, JP, Scientism and Secularism. Last episode, we discussed the basic idea that scientism is the view that science is the only way or the vast superior way to acquire knowledge of reality. And you pointed out that that very assertion is a philosophical statement about science, not a specimen of scientific research itself. And so by its own criteria, could not be knowledge, couldn't, you know, live up to its own expectations and therefore is self-refuting. So let's extend this conversation now to this. If science is not the only kind of reliable knowledge, give us one example of a bit of philosophical knowledge that you would consider reliable, and therefore, again, an argument against scientism.
Yes, there in the book, Michael, let me relate this to a few chapters there.
Okay.
I raise three problems with scientism and go into great detail about in beefing these problems up. One is the problem of self-refutation that you just mentioned. There is another version of scientism called weak scientism that says that, well, science might not be the only way that we gain rational knowledge about reality, but it is vastly superior, and other fields may give us a little bit of reasonable justification for some beliefs. Mm-hmm. But when science moves into that area, if science makes statements too, they trump the statements of that discipline. And so what I've done is I've added two other areas of refutation of scientism that cover both the weak and strong version, so that in some I have three objections to scientism. Besides the self-refutation, my second objection to scientism in both forms answers your question now.
Okay.
And that is that science rests on a number of assumptions. If you're going to take the successful theories of science in a realist way, and I mean by that they're assertions are at least approximately true descriptions of the external world, and some of the theoretical entities that they postulate, like electrons or genes or what have you, are actually real, then the assumptions of science have got to be justified. The problem today, Michael, is that every single one of the assumptions of science are widely rejected and criticized in the academic community. And I'll list some in a minute. But what that means is that there is an urgent task of stating and defending the assumptions of science if the claims of science are going to be understood in a realist way as truths about reality. Unfortunately, the task of clarifying and defending the assumptions of science are philosophical tasks, and they are in no way things that science itself can do. Thus, a field is no stronger than the assumptions on which it rests, and that means that the philosophical defense of the assumptions of science is more cognitively important and weighty than the claims of science on which those assumptions rest.
Right.
Those assumptions would be things like this. The laws of logic and mathematics are items of knowledge and are true. The laws of logic and mathematics apply to reality. Truth is some version of the correspondence theory of truth, where truth is a matching between an assertion or theory and the external world. Knowledge or a good explanation is one that conforms to certain philosophical criteria. So scientists claim that this explanation is a better one than that one, but that claim presupposes an understanding of the different kinds of explanations and what makes an explanation a good one. That's a whole branch of philosophy, that there is an external world that is not constructed by our language or our theories, and that our minds and senses are adequately equipped not only to know the external world, Michael, but to be able to penetrate beyond sense perception and know the laws and the properties that govern unobservable entities like quarks and subatomic particles that explain why the world of observation is what it is. Evolution would only produce faculties that were able to deal with the sense perceptible world, and they wouldn't even have to deal with that world accurately to survive. But in no way would it develop faculties that would be able to penetrate the sense perceptible world and know laws and know the value of the principle of simplicity and all that sort of thing. That is knowledge that is philosophical and it is assumed by science.
Exactly.
So that's basically the second argument.
Now, let me jump in here. You mentioned simplicity as one of the traits of a theory that indicate likely truth. It's something that's, you know, the whole topic of simplicity is a very deep one. Philosophers have analyzed what does it mean? What does it consist of? And there are other virtues of theories besides simplicity that scientists routinely rely upon to identify promising theories or good theories. And in fact, I've written about this, these theoretical virtues or virtues of a theory. My essay can be found by just Googling my last name, Keys, and then virtues. And it's curious, and I want to sort of turn the corner here. One class of those virtues, which again, the point you're making is these virtues themselves are not the results of scientific research. They are presupposed by scientists. Scientists use them in their background, in their framework of thinking, to do science.
That's absolutely right.
But there's a class of these theory virtues called diachronic virtues that only show themselves over time, like durability, a theory that withstands attempts to defeat it over and over and over, over decades of time or whatever. Durability is something that can only surface by looking at the history of science. And so even the history of science, or fruitfulness, whether a theory over time produces additional knowledge beyond what was originally envisioned in the framing of the theory. So here's an example where some of these presuppositions of science also require historical work to establish them. And history is, for many stricter forms of scientism, is considered beyond science. So isn't that interesting how we come at this from so many different angles and we still see the shortcomings of scientism? Any comments about the importance of history for...
This is an absolutely powerful point. And way back in 1989, in my original book that you mentioned earlier, I list a whole range of epistemic virtues that accrue to a theory that can confer a rationality to some degree on that theory. And two comments. One is that, as you know, these virtues can compete with one another. One theory can exhibit virtues A, B, and C, and its rival, D, E, and F. And so weighing the relevancy and weightiness of those virtues is really not a scientific task. It requires some philosophical reflection. The other point I want to make is that you are absolutely right. A number of these virtues are not static and synchronic. They're diachronic, and they can only be understood by observing the research program that develops over time regarding that theory. And my view is that the historian of science can observe this in a whole host of research programs and come up with some epistemic virtues that seem to be exhibited by successful research programs over time, and then use those as a part of the evaluation of another theory that's been around. And I think that that cannot be reduced to philosophy or any other field. It is irreducibly a history of science practice. And to summarize, science cannot function without the history and philosophy of science, but scientists are not educated today to know that.
That's their misfortune, isn't it? But
it really is.
But as historians and philosophers of science work together with scientists, we can educate each other. We all need each other to have a better grasp of how the human mind works to engage and grasp the world. Thanks.
And that's why Christians should be at the forefront, because we believe in the unity of knowledge, since it all came from one rational mind, and we would have extra reason to think that philosophy, history of science, and science itself, in addition to some theological reflections on science, would eventually harmonize and form a unified knowledge of reality.
And JP, that's in fact one of the driving forces of the scientific revolution, and even in the Middle Ages. That, for example, Johannes Kepler, his works just drip with theological reflection, and these were substantive ideas that drove successful science, a point I make in my own book. So, JP, we just got to work together on this stuff, don't we?
Yeah, dude, you are so right. But we really have to alert the public, youth leaders, our Christian school teachers, parents that are raising their kids. We need to alert them to the fact that scientism is really at the bottom of the turmoil we're facing in culture. Barna did a study recently and found that the six reasons that people are leaving Christianity for atheism are all intellectual reasons, and a couple of them deal with the inability of the church to help believers know how to relate their theology and their biblical beliefs to science. And science trumps. And so we have retreated to faith, and the culture has become morally relativistic because the major things about religion and politics and ethics can't be known scientifically. So what scientism has done is funded relativism in culture and blind faith commitments in Christianity. And that isn't sustaining people when they get out of our youth groups and go to college or go into the workforce and meet thoughtful, intelligent unbelievers who will say things like, well, prove it. You can't prove Christianity scientifically, so I don't have to listen to you. Well, I mean, they don't know what to say. And so my book is an attempt to do what you're calling us to do, and that is to work together with our Christian leaders and parents to give them a tool they can learn about themselves and teach our kids and inoculate them responsibly so that they're not sucked into a culture of scientism.
Hey, talking about dude, I need to shut this faucet off for just a bit. And we're going to wrap this up and continue this conversation. Many of our listeners are not religious, but are enthusiastic about intelligent design as a research program. So when we come back, I'm going to ask you some questions about that. Thanks, JP, for joining us.
Good to be with you.
I'm Mike Keith. Thanks for joining us at ID the Future.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.